This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is writer and humorist Bruce J. Friedman. In addition to laboring over the typewriter, writing novels and scripts, in the last few years he's had to master the arcane language of Hollywood deal-making as he's established himself as a screenwriter. He wrote the story and co-authored the screenplay for the hit movie Splash, about the romance between a New Yorker and a mermaid. And he wrote the screenplay for Stir Crazy, the prison comedy which starred Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder. The Steve Martin comedy, The Lonely Guy, was inspired by Friedman's book of the same name, and the comedy Dr. Detroit, starring Dan Aykroyd, was based on Friedman's short story Detroit Abe. Bruce J. Friedman got his start editing men's adventure magazines. He was able to quit in 1966 with the success of his second novel, A Mother's Kisses, about a 17-year-old Jewish boy's ambivalent relationship with his overbearing and possessive mother. That was soon followed by his off-Broadway successes, Scuba-Duba and Steam Bath. There aren't many writers who have successful novels, plays, and movies. I asked Bruce J. Friedman how he describes himself to people who ask him what he does.
I tend to say I do all kinds of writings. I do books and plays, and lately I've been doing some screen work is the way I phrase it, and they perk up when you say screen work, and the next question is, what movies have you worked on? And there is obviously, you know, more curiosity about movies. Books in Hollywood are now called hieroglyphics.
Meaning what?
So when I told a friend in Hollywood that I was working on a book, he said, "Oh, you're doing hieroglyphics, are you?" You know. So yeah, every movies are on everybody's mind.
How did you make the transition from novels to screenplays? I know there were plays in between.
Well, I usually think it was very smooth, and then I think about my first experience, in which I was asked to do a movie for Alan Pakula many years ago. And I remember writing 200 pages, essentially clearing my throat. And he quite correctly, although I was irritated at the time, pointed to a line, a moment on the last page, and said, "This is where we begin. This is a nice picture." He was absolutely right. In other words, however obvious it may seem, making that connection that movies are writing pictures and that, you know, your eloquence is really not that essential is a tough jump for someone like me. It took a while to see that. I think I can pretty much see it now. It's a strange kind of work, screen work, because even the way the business is structured, you know as you're writing that it's not going to happen that way. You know, it's... you're writing. It's probably unique in that the way the contracts are arranged. Even if you were to hand in a perfect screenplay, perfect in every possible way, Citizen Kane or All About Eve, it would be called a first draft, and by definition would have to be, you know, rewritten. So what you're doing in a screenplay, for what I'm doing is telling a story kind of simply in pictures and giving guidelines to the next person who takes it over, the director. The screenwriter is really low man, as you know, on the totem pole, and maybe that's the way it should be.
It's always been my impression that it's like poison for a director to have a screenwriter on the set while they're shooting.
Well, I was invited to be around for one day in the shooting of Stir Crazy, and it was at a time when Gene Wilder gets up on an artificial bull in the prison, and he began to sort of pet the bull and say, "Nice horsey, nice horsey." Well, I don't write "nice horsey," and I never would write "nice horsey." I don't like people who say "nice horsey" if they're grown up. And so I turned around and left, and that was my one experience on the set. No, I guess not. Some do. For example, on The Lonely Guy, which I didn't write, but I did write the source material, Steve Martin was very anxious to have me around. I don't like to be around in that kind of quasi situation. I either like to control the work, which I do when I write a novel or a story, or not. I don't mind being a busboy in screenwriting, in the movies. You get paid decently, and it's, if I were more interested in movies than I am, I would go about it an entirely different way. I'd learn the camera. I'm not intimidated by that, and I'd make the movie.
You wrote the screen story and co-wrote the screenplay, according to the credits, when they were all for Splash. Yeah. Now, what does that mean?
I'll tell you how that originated. Well, there's one kind of interesting thing. When people see a fruit salad of names credited with the screenplay, screen story adaptation, they usually think that those people all sat around in a room and know each other and perhaps love each other. Chances are they've never met each other. They might hate each other. One got fired and the other got hired, and they may not ever speak, and they may all get up and at the Academy Awards together and look as if they love each other. Splash originated with a call I got in 1979 saying, how would I like to write a movie about one of my lonely guys. The Lonely Guy book had just come out, meeting and falling in love with a mermaid. I'm quick to make up my mind. I'm interested in mermaids and legends of the deep, etc. So I said, okay, and I began, and I wrote about half a dozen versions of it. It was tough to get the movie on. Nobody wanted it, and I forgot about it. And then I read, actually, that the interest had revived with Disney and that they were going to proceed, but they wanted my work rewritten by a team of writers. This is what happened. You know, some work remains and some doesn't, and the actual credits, which are a little more scrambled in this case than usual, was sort of arrived at by a board of arbitrators at the Writers Guild.
Was there something that you came up with that really helped the whole story suddenly fall into place?
I can't honestly say. I think initially, yes. It's not that clear in the movie as it exists, but what helped me was getting, it's not clear. It may not, it's obviously it's not necessary because the picture was successful without it. But initially there was a time schedule, meaning if, in mythology, if a mermaid is, quote, seen by a mortal, she has 7 days to either marry the mortal or legitimize the situation, or she turns to foam. So that gave it a kind of time clock. And I thought it was sort of exciting. You were aware that time was going by. And then the hero at one point read about this or something and then knew that there was just a short period, and if he didn't get her by then, she turned to foam. That helped. That getting a time schedule in this particular film. Well, one thing that was lost, I'm sure they had good reasons for doing it, but initially my heroes were in the smoked fish business. So I got to research smoked fish, and I had a lot of fun with that, and they're in the fruit business now.
So did you like Splash when you saw it on the screen?
I brought a lot of negative baggage to it because of the politics of it, frankly, but I found the picture so endearing. Ultimately, it's sort of like a puppy that kept, running after me, and finally I picked it up and loved it. I thought it worked out nicely.
Let's talk about The Lonely Guy. Now, that was adapted from original material that you wrote. I don't understand all the Hollywood
Do you mean the film itself?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll tell you how that worked. Initially, it was a group of articles, most of which appeared in Esquire. They were knitted together in the form of a book called The Lonely Guy. This came to the attention of Steve Martin and Neil Simon, who said this would make an interesting movie. So they optioned the material, and Neil Simon did a screenplay based on my book. Work was done on his script by two screenwriters. So the way that worked was based on a book by me, adaptation by Neil Simon and screenplay by these other two gentlemen. That's how that worked. A little unusual.
Now, your book, The Lonely Guy, was a comedic guide for the lonely man. And it was almost like a parody self-help book. How much of the material from that was used in the movie?
They used some specifics, some of the stuff around the apartment. It's a little hard for me to recall. I know Steve Martin, when I met him afterwards, kept going back and saying, we should have used more of the book, we should have used more of the book. They improvised a lot in the film. I think that gave it a kind of choppy feeling.
When you wrote your book, The Lonely Guy, were you living alone then?
Yes, I was, and everything in it was rooted in some kind of reality for me. When I said, clench your teeth and set the table for one, otherwise, no matter how difficult it is, otherwise you might wind up eating in tears over the sink. I believe that. So everything was real, but skewed slightly for whatever comedic effect. I was living alone, and then the second I finished the book, I met someone I liked and eventually married, thereby invalidating everything in the book.
We see you could have marketed by saying, if you follow my advice, maybe you'll get married too.
It was a total accident, but it was almost true. It was just the... that's the way it happened. So now I'm half writing a book called How to Live with Another Person, which would be a sequel.
One of the parts that I found especially funny in the Lonely Guy in the book was your suggestions about how to dine out alone. Is that something that had really given you problems?
Come to think of it, that was that part of the film was direct from the book. That sequence was filmed I forced myself to do research. It used to be a little bit of a problem, but I forced myself one afternoon to go to the Caravelle, a real fine French restaurant, and to sit alone, even though everyone else in the restaurant was part of a couple. No one has lunch alone in that situation. So, and I took notes. And in taking notes, someone thought I was a restaurant critic, you know. That was personal experience. I think to this day you treat it in a preposterous way if you go into a large restaurant alone and looked at as if you have AIDS or something. You
know? It's really hard to not be self-conscious when you're eating alone.
Yeah. Now, my wife says that she can do it easily, but she reads a book, and I call that working with a net. It doesn't count, you know.
My guest is novelist, screenwriter, and playwright, Bruce J. Friedman. Let's talk a little bit about Stir Crazy. You wrote... did you write the screenplay for Stir Crazy?
Yes.
Okay. And how did that come about?
A wonderful woman named Hannah Weinstein, who died last year, approached me with two words, a prison rodeo. There was a phenomenon called the prison rodeo, which takes place in Texas, in which the prisoners... get to ride in the rodeo for not so much for charity, but so they can get ping pong tables and improve the game rooms. Was I interested? Well, I was. So I went down to the prison to Huntsville, Texas, and did a lot of research there and spent time in the prisons and with ex-prisoners. Even though the work is some kind of comedy, it was all rooted in real stuff. And I was so depressed by the experience that I couldn't work, and especially the idea of doing by the Texas prison system, which is which is so beautiful and clean. Everyone wears white, and it's run so efficiently that it was sickening. I mean, worse than Rikers. So I couldn't work, and then all of a sudden I did, and I came up with this story. And... Richard Pryor, and I didn't write it for anybody in particular, but Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder miraculously signed on, and it was a big commercial success. Sidney Poitier directed it, and had a happy ending. That's the story of that.
So now that you've been writing a lot of movies, you've met a lot of, quote, movie stars. Did you ever go through a period of feeling intimidated by famous movie actors?
Yeah, I did. Not as much as sports figures, actually. Those people are really into, I mean, great athletes always really get me kind of shake, you know, like a fan. Movie stars, I'm wondering if there's anyone at this point who would intimidate me. I don't think so. At the beginning, it seemed like big stuff.
Who was difficult to meet in the beginning?
Oh, just about anybody. Yeah, I know. I became friends with Peter Falk, but I remember going to a ball game with him, a basketball game with him. I was very much aware that I was with Peter Falk, and it was at the height of his Columbo fame. And that's famous. You know, the waves of people calling him Columbo and just parting like the Red Sea was an absolutely incredible experience. Sidney Poitier in the prison in Huntsville. See the reaction that he gets. You know, people who had been bent over with age and been in that prison for years just rose up as if they'd seen the Lord. Some of these movie star faces, Poitier said to me that it's the first time it really struck home that he has trouble. He said he envies me, someone like me, in a sense. I can go to a bar, hang out, just sort of roam around. It's valuable to me as a writer. Nobody knows me. But he said that, you know, he has trouble. He couldn't go to a bar. He's Sidney Poitier. And there are probably more famous faces than his, you know, at this point. And it's the first time that ever struck home that that's could be a problem. I guess the other kind of problem's worse for an actor when nobody knows him. But it could be a drag, and that happens all over the world to these people. Intimidated? I'm just trying to think. I did a little work with Barbara Streisand. I was very, very intimidated by the fact of her being so famous. I think a little less and less because I bounced off a whole bunch of folks just by the nature of what I do. In every area, your circle of heroes begins to shrink as you get older.
When your first two novels came out, Stern and A Mother's Kisses, many critics compared you to other Jewish writers like Philip Roth and Saul Bellow. Do you see yourself as fitting into a certain niche in Jewish American literature?
No.
What do you think of that moniker of, you know, like, Jewish American writer?
Not much, really. I once, someone was asking me what I was, in a bar once, and I sort of knew what they were getting at. It's what's your nationality? That series of questions, you know. Well, my parents were born in Hungary, Romania. But they don't really want to know. I'm an American, you know, a third-generation American. All right, I'm Jewish. That's what you really wanted to, you know. No, and on one situation, I heard myself calling myself a Jewish American. I felt like an absolute moron for weeks.
What?
I'm playing with this. I sounded absurd, you know, to say that. I'm playing with these with this. Business now. I wrote this book, Stern, and I've been making a kind of feeble attempt to feel my way into a book that would sort of, be that character like that 25 years later, because it is 25 years later. And I'm sort of playing with that that stuff right now.
Well, your novel, A Mother's Kisses, was recently republished in a new edition. And do you want to describe what the mother's like in that novel? What kind of character you've given her?
Oh, well, I can just use the critics' words, you know, outrageous, larger than life, flamboyant, theatrical.
Overbearing.
Overbearing. I think if I were to write the book now, I think I'd write it with a more gentle touch and show different colors that weren't, quite as, overbearing, as to use your word.
How did your mother react to that book? Because, I mean, everyone read it as being somewhat autobiographical. And it would have been, I mean, not a condemnation, but very critical of a lot of things that your own mother had done. How did she handle that?
Fine. She was just seemed very pleased with the whole experience. I think she was just stunned that things worked out the way they did for me. Insofar as they've worked out, I don't think there was any indication that any. There wasn't any seedbed in my home or in my family or relations. There wasn't any indication that somebody could come out of that group and become a published writer and have a little success with his work. It was all. I mean, they were a little dazzled by it.
Well, sure. Isn't your father in the garment industry?
Yeah.
There aren't. I mean, yeah. There's no nothing.
Writers come out of
no examples.
The
yeah.
They really are. It's a mutational thing. Very often, the writers I know come out of nowhere. Capote came out of nowhere. Mario Puzo came it didn't come out of any sort of literary seedbed, particularly that you could identify. It's strange about writers.
Well, it
there
is.
Weren't,
yeah.
We weren't bookish. There were no books. There were three or four books, but somehow
I found
the library.
How did you know you wanted to be a writer?
I'm not sure I wanted to be a writer. I just circumstances came up. It was a way to get attention, to attract girls.
Now, how does writing attract girls?
Well, if you didn't know how to speak to a young woman, let's say, then it was girls. If you didn't know how to talk to girls, you could kind of talk to, if you were really seriously shy, but beyond shy, but just paralyzed with fear, you could show some side of yourself by writing a funny column in a newspaper. That's what drew me to writing.
You got your start in writing, editing men's adventure magazines, right?
Not really. I wrote some short stories that got published. The first and probably only job I had was editing some men's adventure magazines in the early 50s. I worked for that company for about a decade. And then I quit, and I haven't really had an honest job since.
What were the names of the magazines?
Male, Men, Man's World, and my favorite, which is True Action, was one.
That's great.
As opposed to False Action.
What kinds of stuff did you have in them?
Adventure stories, they kind of looked, a lot of stories that might appeal to World War II veterans. They look kind of raunchy, but they really weren't. We use the word nympho a lot, but the actual text was absurdly tame. Forget about by today's standards, but even back then. But they were kind of fun. We had good writers. Mario Puzo, you probably know, was. One of them, one of the associate editors, and a number of people who've—it was an amazing group. A number of people who've, I suppose you're supposed to say, gone on to write books and screen work, etc. It was a lot of fun back then.
How did you get out of that and figure that it was okay to leave that security of a job and just start writing?
Toughest thing I've ever had to do.
Yeah.
It took me about, I had three small children and no money to accumulated. And I just kind of had enough, and I knew it was then or never. I sensed that, and it took me about a year and a half to make up my mind. And I was against the advice of the publisher, who's a, sort of a nice man and a friend, who said, you're not ready to do this yet. You should stay here a few more years. That was scary. It took me a year and a half to make up my mind to do it, and exactly an hour to accommodate to the new situation. I did have the leverage, if you will, of one screen job, but it was a very modest figure, and it was bumpy for a while. I'm real proud of doing that. I really am. I was scared out of my wits. It wasn't just me. I had to support a whole family, and it was touch and go there for a while. The screen work petered out. I did pieces for the Saturday Evening Post then, which were fun, but, you know, the economics were harsh. And then I tried writing a play, and amazingly, it worked, and it was a big hit for the time, and that got me over that hurdle. Never thought of, I wouldn't have known what kind of career to switch to, so here I am still doing it.
Can I ask you a question about your name? Is there a reason why you've decided to use your middle name in your name?
Well, those were the names that were given to me. And for a while, it was kind of a nuisance, and I thought, well, maybe I'll leave it out. Somewhere along the line, I began to read about a whole bunch of other Bruce Friedmans who were lawyers, owning restaurants around the city, et cetera, et cetera. And I decided to just keep the name. And also, if I yanked out the middle name, it would get confusing or something. So I'm a little, I don't know, it became some kind of signature. And sometimes it's been a nuisance. I don't know how I feel about that. I just sort of let it go.
Screenwriter, novelist, and playwright Bruce J. Friedman. His latest novel is Tokyo Woes. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The technical director for this edition of Fresh Air was Jay Goldman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible by support from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and its 16 undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.